This weekend starts right after this. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.
From Compass Media Networks, this is America's First News. This weekend with your host, Gordon Deal.
The mental toll of lockdowns. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Final weekend of June. Here's what's coming up this hour. Isolation for children who are home from school thanks to coronavirus restrictions can leave an enduring psychological mark. We'll explain how. Also, the new challenge for theater owners these days, not which movies to show, but how to reopen without alarming the customers. Plus, butterfly kits are popular for kids in quarantine, but they've also led to tough conversations about certain caterpillar behavior. And never mind the do-it-yourself haircut during lockdowns, the hair trend generating the most buzz is the mullet.
People were stuck at home, they were cutting their own hair, and then that was kind of fueling some pretty funny haircuts, you know, head on. You can cut your own hair and you can do the front okay, but the back is kind of difficult. And so a lot of guys were embracing that, impossibility to get an accurate haircut.
Jacob Gallagher at the Wall Street Journal on the mullet. Who's wearing it and its history? Well, if you've got kids at home, you may be seeing this personally. With many summer camps canceled, many families continuing to practice social distancing, and the upcoming school year a big question mark, pediatricians and psychologists are raising alarms about the potential impact of prolonged social isolation on children. More from Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. Andrea, what are we learning?
Basically, you know, now that many summer camps are canceled and a lot of families are continuing to practice social distancing, and also the upcoming school year is really looking, you know, no one really knows exactly what school is going to look like, whether it will be online or in person or a mixture of both. And even if it is in person, you know, social distancing will likely still need to be practiced. And so pediatricians and psychologists are really starting to raise alarms about the potential impact of prolonged social isolation on children. There's a lot of research that shows various benefits of positive peer relationships. You know, children who have them are more likely to later develop healthy romantic relationships and be more effective at work. Good relationships with peers during the teen years are linked to better health during adulthood. And there's all sorts of things that kids learn from their peers that they really can't learn anywhere else.
Yeah. All right. So I believe there was an expert in your story who said this type of situation, these lockdowns, can be most devastating to teens. How come?
So I talked to one expert who studies teens, and he said that, you know, according to him, all the age groups, teens seem to be having the hardest time with it. You know, they're bored, they're lonely. And what's interesting about the teen years is it's really when kids start to pull away from their parents and gravitate towards their friends for social support, for love, for information. So it's quite challenging where, you know, younger kids might be more amenable to being with the family and getting a lot of needs met that way. You know, for teens, it's really difficult. And a lot of them are, you know, they're trying to become more independent and autonomous. And this is really, you know, making that difficult.
Yeah. How about the physical interaction, even at, I don't know, the younger ages, like kindergarten-ish?
Right. So for the preschool years are another age group that doctors are quite concerned about, because with little kids, you know, playing with other children, first of all, learning to share, learning how to sort of regulate your emotions, really, and also learning to take the perspective of another person are, one expert told me, these are really core moral building blocks of things like empathy, negotiation, collaboration, cooperation, and they really need to be done hands-on. I mean, if you think about the way very young children play, it's they're playing together with a toy. They're really in each other's physical space. I mean, so, you know, part of it, they don't necessarily have the self-control to stay 6 feet apart, of course. And then also their play really involves you know, needs sort of hands-on connection.
We're speaking with Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. She's written a piece about the toll that isolation is taking on kids during the coronavirus era. That could mean, I guess, that you lose some of your social skills, right? So going back to school could be awkward.
Right, right. Well, psychologists and doctors are really concerned about children who are already socially anxious or who have difficulty making and keeping friendships. So these kids, you know, they may actually find this period of time fairly comfortable because, you know, they're not having to sort of navigate the social minefield of the playground or the lunchroom. But when they go back, you know, but then again, their social skills might be atrophying. And so when they go back, it's going to be very, very tough for them to keep, you know, to kind of, you know, negotiate those relationships once things get to some sort of normal. And so, you know, doctors are saying that people really need to, you know, parents really need to make an effort to, you know, encourage those as much social contact as they can. Several physicians I talked to and psychologists really were proponents of the pod idea or the quarantine, where, and it's really suggesting that families who have been very careful about social isolating team up with another family who've been doing the same, and to allow for in-person play dates without social distancing. So that is something that people are already doing, and that does seem to be a recommendation by several of the experts that I talked to. One expert said that even just being with one peer, just one friend, can make a huge difference.
Thanks, Andrea. Andrea Peterson, reporter at the Wall Street Journal. 12 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend.
We're all in uncharted territory, looking for ways to support our communities. At Dell Technologies, we're making sure small businesses have the right tech solutions. Dell Technologies advisors are here for you, from helping small businesses stay connected and productive while working remotely with Windows 10 and Microsoft Teams, to rapidly deploying remote work solutions that limit upfront costs with Dell Financial Services. We're standing by you every step of the way. Call 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL.
Hey, thanks for spending part of your weekend with us. Most college administrators are mulling over how to restart their programs with no end in sight for the public health crisis. According to the Chronicle of Higher Education, which is tracking more than 860 plans, two-thirds of colleges are planning to welcome back students in person, while only 7% are planning to hold classes only online. Many other colleges have yet to make a decision. Here's how varied their approaches are from Samuel Zwickel, reporter at USA Today. Samuel, what have you put together?
I think in the whole history of higher education, wars and plagues have been about the only crises significant enough to disrupt a semester. And we saw this in the middle of March. Students were forced to evacuate their dorm rooms, say rushed goodbyes to their friends, and finish their classes online. Graduations were postponed, often went remote. So with scientific experts warning we could see a second wave of COVID-19 in the fall, universities are really thinking out of the box in terms of how to keep academics in motion come September.
So it seems like maybe some retail practices will be adopted. I think you referenced directional hallways or perhaps one-way hallways.
That's right. You know, Gordon, this school year is full of known unknowns, and I'd say the only thing we know for sure is that students won't be returning to the college experience they left. So just to use your imagination, you'll be wearing masks in all public spaces, in the dining hall, in the student commons. You might be tuning into a lot of classes from your dorm room. People on your floor might need to schedule up for a time to use the shower, but you might have a single room. And so we see at schools like Duke, they're actually finding new housing stock in local hotels and apartments.
All right, so you referenced the showering. I think there was a reference in your story about Florida A&M University showering at scheduled times. What does that accomplish? It seems almost frightening in a way.
That's right. I think the idea is to keep students, you know, as spread apart as possible. And that's what the social distancing is really for in terms of the housing. We're seeing even whole floors to quarantine students in different parts of the dorms, maybe one dorm set aside for students who get sick, who come into contact with others who catch the coronavirus.
Jeez. All right. So as you referenced in the story, part of the problem here, or part of what administrators are trying to reckon, is that they need students on campus for revenue purposes.
I think that's so right. You know, it's about universities' bottom line for sure. There's a concern about dropping enrollment that leads to dropping tuition. And the financial fallout of the pandemic was really hitting these institutions hard. You know, before we had to look at this for the fall, we're seeing cuts on campuses across the country. In particular, at the University of Michigan's Flint campus, they just laid off 41% of their lecturers or had to cut hours on them. But college presidents I've been talking to also say they realize that virtual courses are tough on these kids. It's hard to stay motivated working from home, and it's really not an ideal learning environment a lot of the time. Students might be responsible for childcare for their siblings, for taking care of their parents, for elderly grandparents, and they might not have the resources to engage with school in a productive way if they don't have good internet connectivity or whatever else.
We're speaking with Samuel Zwickel. He's a reporting intern for USA Today, and he's written a piece about colleges' coronavirus reopening plans for this fall, and they're just as varied as you can possibly imagine, as he pieces together in his story. At Syracuse, for example, you referenced alternating in-person classes. So what, do you go to class on, say, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and the other half of the students go Tuesday, Thursday, some other time?
That's exactly right. And so students are swapping spots on alternating days. We're also seeing some creative block scheduling models at some other colleges. So, for example, at Center College in Kentucky, they're dividing the term into two blocks of courses, each 6 weeks with a few days long. And in that way, fewer classes at a time would be disrupted by a potential outbreak in case part of the semester needs to be online and the other part can be in person. We're also seeing some interesting models, like the University of Colorado at Boulder, where they're planning to put first-year students who often take a lot of the same introductory courses in together living situations called social cohorts. And so you'll be in the same dorm with people you're going to classes with, and the idea is that you won't run into as many people. There'll be less spread of the virus if somebody gets it.
Interesting. Disappointing socially, I guess, but an interesting approach. What is what's the thinking, Samuel, for some of these schools that might end this fall semester before Thanksgiving?
Right. So the idea is that, you know, students coming to America's universities come from all across the country in a lot of cases, sometimes all around the world. And so colleges don't want kids to go home on their vacations to see family and then, you know, bring the disease back if they happen to get it in their hometown. So a lot of universities are starting the year early, and then they'll end again a bit early, or they'll continue finals and classes after Thanksgiving online.
Thanks, Samuel. Samuel Zwickel, reporter at USA Today. It is 22 minutes now after the hour on This Weekend. Coming up next, convincing moviegoers that theaters are safe. Movie theaters are encountering a slew of challenges as they lurch toward reopening after a three-month shutdown, including well-documented obstacles such as a lack of new movies and capacity legally capped as low as 25%. But those who run theaters say an even bigger challenge is emerging, reading and relieving the worries of a fragile customer base, because movie theaters thrive on a sense of refuge. It's a story by Steven Zeitchik, reporter covering the business of entertainment at the Washington Post. Steven, we forget the role theaters play, like an escape.
Well, that's right, Gordon. I mean, you know, one thing I think just even before kind of we get into the specific psychological tactics they're trying is just, as you say, the role they play in society. And, you know, right now in the last 3-4 months, most of us have been in lockdown and isolated and at home, and I just kind of cut off, you know, some video calls, notwithstanding, from friends, family, colleagues. And, you know, movie theaters are even in good times, of course, are a way for us to come together. And I think particularly in times when we've been so isolated and atomized, forgetting about, you know, politics and all the other issues that divide us these days. So I think they have a really important role to play here. You know, never mind the escapism that they provide, taking us to alternate worlds. But certainly, as you say, in terms of bringing us together, movie theaters play a unique role. Now, as far as the psychology goes, it's really been kind of fascinating because, you know, theaters are not usually in the business of making customers anxieties go away. You know, they do a lot of things well. They entertain us. Again, they help us escape. They often feed us. But the idea of really playing to anxieties and a very diverse set of anxieties is not a role that they're usually put in, and that's exactly what the reopening and the pandemic have done.
We speak with Steven Zajcik. He covers the business of entertainment for The Washington Post. His piece is called As Movie Theaters Reopen, They're Tackling a Role They Never Expected to Play, and that's psychologist. All right, so you open your piece talking about this guy, Chris Johnson, who owns some theaters across Illinois and Wisconsin. What is he saying?
Yeah, so you know, Chris Johnson is a kind of prototypical independent theater owner. He owns a fair number of theaters, more than a dozen, but he's not a big chain, and he can kind of use some sort of personal touch or technique to make people feel comfortable. And the big takeaway, you know, like a lot of theaters, he's figuring out how to do that. One big takeaway that he kind of came away with after studying this was that if you really emphasize the health and safety concerns, if you kind of put people in masks on your poster and you kind of talk about disinfectant and you talk about social distancing, all that, of course, needs to be done. There's no question about that. But if you emphasize that too much in your messaging, he said that people really get turned off. The analogy he gave was to the TSA and taking a flight. You know, we want to know when we get on a plane that we're being kept safe. That doesn't mean we like going through scanners four times or having our bags rifled through. Certainly thinking about that might make some of us hesitate when it comes to taking a flight or taking too many flights. So I think he's really trying to walk the line between keeping people safe and letting people know that they're safe and overemphasizing those aspects that really might just scare us into staying home.
Somebody had said, too, hey, it's a dark room with a bunch of strangers. You got to feel comfortable going in there.
No, that's exactly right. And that's, you know, every theater owner has kind of pointed to, you know, unlike, you know, even a restaurant, there's a restaurant, a lot of them can do outdoor dining, but even a restaurant or a store where, you know, you're pretty much, you know, some restaurants you may linger in, but there are fewer people, it's well-lighted, a store you're usually going in and getting out fairly quickly. You know, a theater, you're really putting your trust in a kind of foreign environment. Everything is dark. There are a lot of people around you don't know. You're kind of stuck in place. And so everyone that I talked to for this story have been trying to figure out how to make people feel comfortable. And one gentleman who runs a bunch of theaters out in the Nebraska region, William Barstow, runs, I think, 8 locations, about 50 screens out there, was saying that, you know, so much of what he has to do is have employees communicate with guests, with customers, and kind of let them know that they're in good hands.
Steven Zajcik covers the business of entertainment at The Washington Post. 30 minutes after the hour on This Weekend. Even in tough times, you want to try to look your best, even if it's just from the waist up for those video chats. So when it comes to your facial hair, Harry's has you covered, bringing you incredibly high-quality blades at factory direct prices, just $2 per blade. Now, when it comes to my facial hair, I'm typically a goatee guy, but lately I've been using these times of home quarantine to experiment with a full beard. This has allowed the precision trimmer blade on my Harry's razor to take center stage. I use it to make sure my new beard is looking its best. Now you can keep your face looking smooth too, or your beard looking clean, with a Harry's trial set delivered right to your doorstep. Just go to harrys.com/gordon to order yours. And get this, to help support those who need it the most right now, Harry's is donating $1 million worth of shaving supplies to hospitals across the U.S. so you can feel good about looking good. Listeners of our show can redeem their Harry's trial set at harrys.com/gordon. You'll get a weighted ergonomic handle for a firm grip, a 5-blade razor with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, rich lathering shave gel with aloe to keep your skin hydrated, and a travel blade cover to keep your razor dry and easy to grab on the go. Go to harrys.com/gordon to start shaving better today. Final weekend of June. Thanks for spending it with us. I'm Gordon Deal. Coming up this half hour, virus-proofing the new office becomes a booming business. Also, the mullet is back, whether we like it or not, and butterfly kits backfire because of caterpillars behaving badly. We'll have that story in about 20 minutes. With companies pressing to figure out how to safely reopen workplaces, makers of everything from office furniture to smart ventilation systems are rushing to sell them products and services marketed as solutions. Some companies, like makers of thermal cameras that sense skin temperature, are rebranding their wares as virus containment fever scanning products. Others are creating entirely new services. It's a story by Natasha Singer, technology reporter at the New York Times. Natasha, take us through this.
Well, there's a gold rush of vendors trying to sell employers and real estate managers on all these new technologies, starting in the lobby with fever screening cameras and touchless tech so that when you come in, you know, you could wave your hand or phone over the turnstiles so that it will let you in and you don't have to hold up anything. And then, you know, there are these antiseptic covers you can get for buttons in the elevator so people don't have to touch anything. And for buildings that want to go further than that, you know, security companies are making apps so that you can call the elevator and tell it what floor you want to go to, and it'll come in advance, and, like, you won't have to press anything in the elevator. And then there are all these kind of floor markers that companies are putting down, including stores and banks, you know, and workplaces that, like, enforce social distancing so you can stand 6 feet apart and wait for the elevator or wait for a coffee. And it extends to, like, air conditioning filters for major buildings and apps that, you know, track employees when they connect, contact tracing apps, so that it registers who you've been in contact with in the workplace in case a month from now somebody tests positive for the virus. And that will allow HR to sort of create maps of who was near whom, and then you could call certain people and say, hey, you might have been exposed in the workplace. But basically, just the market for these contact tracing apps for the workplace is estimated at $4 billion this year.
Goodness. Wow. All right. So one of the words that you used early on that's key in all this is new. Some of these are new services, which means, I guess, they're unproven, right, or largely untested. Will they work?
Well, even the services that are old, you know, cameras that screen people's skin temperature, you know, that is not a brand new technology, but it's being promoted for a new use, kind of as fever screening for coronavirus. And the problem is, the virus itself is new, and the science on it is emerging, and it's changing all the time, so we don't know what's going to work and what's not. Certainly, employers are doing everything they can to try to make the workplace safer, and even if half the people who have the coronavirus don't have fevers or even more, employers want to catch the few people with obvious symptoms and keep them from coming to work. So I think we can sort of think of it as triage. They're trying to do everything, masks, social distancing, reducing the number of desks on a floor in a building, screening employees for symptoms, and hopefully all together they'll be able to buy down risk.
We're speaking with Natasha Singer, technology reporter at the New York Times. Her piece is called A Multi-Billion Dollar Opportunity, Virus Proofing the New Office. How much does some of this stuff cost?
That's a great question. The issue is that some of it depends on the size of your space or the number of employees, because, for example, some companies are making these symptom checking apps, and employees will have to fill out the symptom questionnaire every day before they go to work and take their temperature. And the costs are like per employee per month. So it could be $5 or $10 per employee per month. But other services are also offering, like, in addition to the health checking apps and, like, kind of doing a walkthrough and a consultation to make sure the workplace is safer, they're also offering virus testing for $150 per employee.
Jeez.
So it depends on the size of the package that employers are getting and how frequent the services are.
Thanks, Natasha. Natasha Singer, technology reporter at the New York Times. It is 21 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend. Thanks for being with us. We all want the good life, right? A wish list might include things like meaningful work, a robust network of friends and family, minimal money worries, service to others, good health, a long life, a sense of both serenity and purpose. So what stands in our way? Jonathan Clements at HumbleDollar.com has a couple of ideas. Jonathan, your take on this.
So one of the things we know, Gordon, is so much of our life is a struggle. We struggle to eat healthily. We struggle to exercise enough. We struggle to save enough. And one of my goals with this particular article was to try to get people to understand the constraints that they face and not to feel too much like a failure when they don't turn out to be that model modern citizen that we strive to be.
All right, so those constraints, for example, might be what?
So first of all, we start with our nature, you know, what we're born with. And you can think of our nature in two different ways. One, there's the collective instincts that we all have, and these are the instincts that we got from our hunter-gatherer ancestors that say we should all consume as much as we can today, that says, you know, we should be really loss averse, which means that we tend to panic when the stock market goes down, which says, you know, hey, if don't exert yourself because you might need that energy later. So those are general attributes that we all tend to have. And then on top of that, we have our own individual talents, and that does clearly constrain us. You know, as I like to tell people, it doesn't matter how many motivational speeches you listen to, it doesn't matter how much you train, most of us are never going to run 100 meters in under 10 seconds. Mm. It simply isn't going to happen. We are constrained not only by our collective instincts, but also by our individual talents.
All right, so some folks have more constraints to overcome than others.
Yeah, so now we're talking about circumstances. And some of us are clearly, you know, raised in, you know, poorer households. Going to college is a struggle. Perhaps our parents set a bad example. We can certainly overcome that background, but, you know, the rougher our background, the harder it's going to be. So we should acknowledge that, you know, getting ahead can be difficult, and it can be more difficult for some of us than others. And then on top of that, and I use the example of my father here, you know, we have to realize that the talents that we have, and everybody, I believe, has talents, we may live at a time when they are not financially rewarded. Mm. In terms of my father, he got out of university in England in 1956, and he decided to take the highest-paying job he was offered. And the highest-paying job he was offered was a job in journalism. Today, the idea that the highest-paid job you would get offered was in journalism?
Jeez, yeah.
Laughable. It wouldn't happen. The world changes over time. The skills that were valued 50 years ago are not valued in the same way today.
We're speaking with Jonathan Clements. He's the founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. He's written a piece entitled In Our Own Way, and it's about what stands in the way of our financial wishes. So tie this all together then. How does this relate to what we're trying to achieve money-wise?
So we're constrained by our natural talents and our instincts. You know, we're held back by our upbringing and by whether the economy rewards our current talents, but then we try to change our life's trajectory. We make choices. And, you know, this striving can be a source of great satisfaction. I believe that we can change our life's trajectory.
Thanks, Jonathan. Jonathan Clements, founder and editor of HumbleDollar.com. It is 14 minutes now in front of the hour on This Weekend.
We're all in uncharted territory, looking for ways to support our communities. At Dell Technologies, we're making sure small businesses have the right tech solutions. Dell Technologies advisors are here for you, from helping small businesses stay connected and productive while working remotely with Windows 10 and Microsoft Teams, to rapidly deploying remote work solutions that limit upfront costs with Dell Financial Services. We're standing by you every step of the way. Call 877-ASK-DELL. That's 877-ASK-DELL.
Glad you're with us. For many Americans, self-isolation has led to questionable at-home haircuts, right? Like the patchy buzz, the uneven bowl cut, but the chop job of the moment that's both most provocative and likely to endure might be the COVID mullet. Here's This Weekend's Jennifer Koshenka.
Another side effect of the pandemic? Mullets. As Jacob Gallagher of the Wall Street Journal tells us, the hairdo, legendary in the 90s, is making a comeback. Jacob, why now?
So effectively, what is happening is that particularly, you know, I started reporting the story out probably a good month ago now, and that was kind of in what I would call the heart to waning days of the quarantine for a lot of people. Now it seems, you know, with barbershops opening back up, that maybe the calculation is going to be a little bit different. But people were stuck at home. They were cutting their own hair. And then that was kind of fueling some pretty funny haircuts. You know, head on, you can cut your own hair and you can do the front okay, but the back is kind of difficult. And so a lot of guys were embracing that, let's say, impossibility to get an accurate haircut and just rocking a full mullet. And then from that, people kind of realized that there's a sort of humor to the haircut. It was providing them a little bit of levity during a time of sheer boredom for a lot of people and darkness for others in a certain way. So that was kind of what gave rise to it.
Jacob, in your story, it kind of was interesting to me because I associate the mullet with the 90s, but apparently it's got kind of an ancient history.
Yeah, it goes all the way back to I believe, if the history is correct, that American Indians wore this hairstyle and kind of had, or a similar hairstyle. I would not say it was exactly that hairstyle, but that kind of shorter in the front, longer in the back hairstyle was seemingly popular back then. And there's some evidence going back to, I believe, the 1800s, if I'm not incorrect there. The term, most interestingly, in contemporary history, if you will, was that the term itself was not really solidified until the 90s, after the mullet had really been quite popular, you know, through the 80s and a lot of country stars having it and what have you. It seems like it was actually a Beastie Boys song that popularized the term mullet itself, and then from there it really caught on, and now it has kind of become this almost comical term at times, but there are people that really do adhere to this hairstyle and quite like it.
We're speaking with Jacob Gallagher of the Wall Street Journal. Jacob, who are some of the more, quote, famous, unquote, people who got them recently or who continue to have them? As you said, they have been popular.
Yeah, so there's obviously the big one on a celebrity scale is Miley Cyrus has had a mullet. She continues to have a mullet. And the interesting thing there being that her father, Billy Ray Cyrus, was kind of one of the big figures that popularized it back in the day. Patrick Kane, who is a very popular and quite good hockey player, has the hairstyle, and it's interesting. Within hockey, it is pretty popular because the back of your hair, the flow, as it is known, can kind of, again, flow out of the back of your helmet. So it's popular in hockey. It's also quite popular in lacrosse, which similarly, you know, young men play the game and have, you know, their hair coming out the back of the helmet there. I spoke to a couple barbers. I've spoken to a couple of barbers about the mullet over time, one particularly for this story, and he was saying that often, you know, whole youth lacrosse teams or youth hockey teams will grow their hair out for the season to get this mullet, and then for playoffs they'll all have it, and they'll be flying about, and that's kind of the whole point of it, as almost like a team bonding thing.
This weekend's Jennifer Koshenko with Wall Street Journal reporter Jacob Gallagher. It is 6 minutes now in front of the hour. On this weekend, glad you're with us. What could be more magical than raising butterflies? The thought drew millions of orders this spring for educational butterfly kits to occupy children during COVID-19 lockdowns. Parents looked forward to their kids watching furry caterpillars transform into fluttering painted ladies. Marcus McNamara, the president of Insect Lore, a popular brand, told the Wall Street Journal that they've never experienced a year like this in 50 years. The company, based in Shafter, California, has been selling 50,000 butterfly kits a day in recent months, at least five times average daily sales last year. Some parents, though, found the nature lessons exceeded expectations, teaching their young children about cannibalism and death, since caterpillars will eat each other. As a two-year-old from Denver observed, quote, "They ate their friends." Not every parent is ready for that. One Amazon reviewer wrote, quote, "If you love teaching your 5 to 8 year olds about death and ruining their childhood, this kit is for you." The reviewer gave it 1 star. I'm Gordon Deal. Thanks for listening to This Weekend. Great news. There's a quick way you could save money. Switch to Geico. Geico could help you get great coverage at a great price, and it only takes 15 minutes to see if you could save 15% or more on car insurance. Go to geico.com today and see how much you could save.